Thank you very much, and it's an absolute pleasure to be here. And as you know, Credit Suisse spends quite a lot of time up in Warwick, and we're absolutely delighted to be here. I'm going to talk about three things. One is China as a competitive threat from an investment side. Secondly, inflation in the emerging markets. And thirdly, the emerging market consumer, with again emphasis on China. I thought that it'd be useful just to talk about how we look at China, non-Japan Asia, and India in an investment criteria. I can also later on talk about the US as well, because my expertise for the last 20 years has been on the US side, so I can look at it from the other angle as well. But I thought we would go this way. The factors really driving development for China as a competitive threat is the fact that, A, it overinvests. Secondly, and I'm sure others will talk about this as well, the renminbi is 44% undervalued versus the dollar. Cost of capital in China is far too low. The Chinese domestic market has reached critical mass. And the example here, the largest auto market in the world. And if you look at the numbers that come through from General Motors, Volkswagen, Mercedes, BMW, etc., China is by far their fastest growing market. We're looking at China being the largest buyer of brand names globally. I thought the last two were very interesting. First of all, China produces twice as many graduates as the US. And I think the last one's incredibly important. The enforcement of IP rights in China is very weak. And I'm sure that you're all aware of the problems that Microsoft has had in China. And I think that the comments, remember how investors underestimated the impact of the Korean and Japanese manufacturers in the global marketplace during their respective investment booms. Well, China is doing exactly the same. And you can see that the sectors that are going to be most vulnerable. And I've got another slide on that in a second. If you look at their last five-year plan, which came in this year, well, so at the end of last year, these are the areas that are going to be very important for them. First of all, new energy, so clean alternative energy, wind power in particular. Secondly, energy conservation and environmental protection. Thirdly, looking at new materials. I don't know if you've been reading in the press the concerns with regards rare earths. There's been a real pressure on all the rare earth suppliers. Biotechnology, IT generation, high-end equipment manufacturing, aerospace is a very important one there. They are about to launch into production their small airliner. They have been very successful in the railway market. They've been very successful in the marine market. And then things such as electric cars, which the US are trying to do, which they're going even faster. I don't know if you can see this, but these are the type of industries and companies that are at risk from Chinese competition. So you can go through areas at the top, such as the industrials and technology, where companies like Huawei have really taken on companies such as Nokia and Alcatel and Ericsson and are winning major contracts in Alcatel's home market. Or we look at things like the industrial equipment side with ABB, Alstom and Siemens, which are very, very big power companies which have big exports into China. The Chinese have got the know-how. And I talked about the aerospace side with regards their new airliner that's coming out, which will be sold into the rest of the world. And then obviously there's things like steel, chemicals, cement, etc. So the real problem, though, with the emerging markets and with China, I think, in particular, which is going to be something that's going to be talked about a lot, is inflation. Interestingly, Argentina, India, and Brazil have negative output gaps above 4% of GDP, which is a level associated with inflation rates of above 5%. The one that everyone focuses on is actually China and where the inflation rate is going. And interestingly, if you look at this chart, Russia and Brazil, which are quite high up with regards to sort of the inflation side, are actually big commodity plays. And so you could see it's not surprising that you have a slight amount of inflation there. But the other concern that we have, and this is where China in particular is a problem, is that real rates are very low. And this is leading to a bubble. And so you have a situation where you have inflation in China, or in current inflation is supposed to be around 4.4%, but could go significantly higher because you're starting to see wage inflation, you're seeing very significant food inflation, and therefore you're likely to see the Chinese government putting on the brakes fairly significantly. And if you look up at the top right-hand corner, you see the countries where inflation is a problem, where the monetary policy is far too loose. And I can see, and India's obviously up there as well, and it has been a problem. This is looking at the Chinese labour market. You can see the demand-supply ratio is edged down from its highs, and the official wage inflation is at average levels around 15.7% year over year. Interestingly, I think the bottom chart is the most important one here, because again, wage inflation is the major problem of inflation rather than food inflation. And if you look at how wage inflation is going on in China, it's still way below where it was, or the growth of it is still way below where it was in 2008. Then I think that this comes to my last piece, which I want to talk about, which I think is probably the most interesting one, is the emerging market consumer and emerging market consumption. We reckon that the GEM consumption share of GDP has to rise. The Chinese consumer share of GDP at the moment is just 35%. I was telling someone about a statistic earlier on. In 1988, the average salary in Korea when they had the Seoul Olympics was $4,000 per annum. At the Beijing Olympics 20 years later, the average salary in China is $4,000. In those 20 years, the salary move from Korea went from $4,000 to $25,000. So you can see that the potential upside is fairly significantly. One thing I would say about China versus India is that the demographics in China aren't as good as they are in India, bearing in mind that we're likely to have, by 2015, 2016, a real problem with the labour force in China because of their one-child policy, unlike India, which has a very, very fast-growing young population. Also, the other thing, difference between India and China, is there tends to be a much larger middle class in India who are already spending, and there is a fast-growing middle class in China, but it's still fairly nascent. I think that another statistic, which is, I'm sorry to bang you with statistics, but I think it's interesting, it's showing how powerful things are. If China grows by 9% per year in real terms between now and 2020, then consumption is likely to grow by 12% and discretionary spending by 14%. Again, what type of things do we look at as investors into China? Well, we look at luxury goods because there's massive demand for that, whether it's Louis Vuitton, Tiffany, BMW, Mercedes. We look at financial services. That most of the big investment banks are already very, very involved in China. But you're seeing the big European insurance companies moving there, doing joint ventures. We look at retailers. Levi have 500 stores in China, and that's growing incredibly fast. And it's very much sort of the high end that matters, because it's what they want to know. So brand names become increasingly important. I was spending time with the management of Guess a few months ago, who were talking about that they've given up, well, they haven't given up, but they've stopped expanding in the US and basically are opening up stores in China because they believe that is where they're going to have the biggest amount of growth. And it's absolutely true. The Chinese want to have the brands, and Guess is a very good brand. This is another statistic with regards the GDP, which I mentioned to you just now. So the current GDP per capita this is for the global emerging markets, is $7,000. When France, US, Japan had GDP at that level, the highest growth is seen in communications, transport, and education. And if you look at what's going on in India with regards to education, what's going on within China with education, it's growing incredibly fast. And I think that statistic I mentioned earlier on about the amount of graduates coming out of China compared to the US really sums it up. And I think you'll see, for instance, communication growing very fast. I mean, if you look at India, the mobile phone system in India is significantly better than most of the places in Europe. Because that's how the growth has been, that's how they've been able how to communicate there. If you look at China, the mobile telephone system is incredibly good, and it's only growing faster. And then if I look at the emerging market consumption map, which I'll put on here, and if you look at the dark areas, these are the prospects where the growth is the best. And I think that what I would sum up is that every country is very different, If you look at India, you can see areas such as utilities, fuel, food and beverage, technology, healthcare, education. If you look at China, it's pretty similar. I think the one, again, I would emphasize, bearing in mind I work for Credit Suisse, is the financial services. This is a very, very fast-growing area in India. And I think that hopefully by sort of looking at the three major sort of topics with regards to the emerging markets, I've given you some view of where we'd be looking to invest. But it does look like China is going to continue to be incredibly important. India is catching up very fast. I think the big difference between India and China with regards investments in the future is that India, it's a democracy, China isn't. China could basically put a road straight through here. In India, you couldn't do that because it's a democracy. That's why China's been growing so fast. But bearing in mind, at some stage, there is going to be a demographic time bomb, which is going to stop China growing quite as fast as they've been growing. Plus, they have the concerns about inflation. India, on the other hand, which produces about 10 kilometers a day of road compared to China of 65 kilometers per day of road, you're beginning to see India grow. And I think that if I personally, and this is my opinion rather than Credit Suisse opinion, if I personally had to look at where I would see the real growth in 10, 15 years' time, I think India will be growing a lot faster. I think there's more transparency with the companies than there are in China. And I think the fact that the democracy side, the democratic side, becomes incredibly important. And I will leave it at that.
Thank you very much.
So my speech would like to focus on the intermingling of South Asian communities, particularly Muslim communities in the UK over the past 40 years or so, and how this intermingling has produced a generation of individuals that were prone to various forms of radicalisation and had developed a kind of a anti-establishment inclinations, let's just say. And I'm going to speak about this based using a lot of personal experience here as well, so bear with me. Central to any discussions are about the radicalisation, integration or alienation of young Muslims of South Asian origin in the West is the question of identity. Not feeling a sense of belonging to the country you are living in can be very disorientating, and it's usually the product of life experience. But it can also be self-imposed or encouraged by the forces of nurture. In a British context, it's a lot more complex. There's a number of variables acting simultaneously. Culture, political climate, upbringing, and other factors have all conspired in the past to produce a situation whereby a collective sense of dislocation has been acutely felt. This has resulted in identity crisis, which certain groups and individuals have managed to exploit. So for myself, as a young boy from a ethnically Pakistani family, growing up in Britain in the 1980s was a very daunting experience. One would become acutely aware of one's brown skin from a very early age and could be constantly reminded of that fact. So being British was not something I wanted to be. It was not something I had a positive view about. For me, it was associated with angry, hostile white people who were trying to go out their way to make me feel like an outsider. Racist attacks, racist graffiti were commonplace. And we were forced to learn to physically defend ourselves from a very early age. And this is at a time when Britain itself was making a transition from having an identity defined along ethnic lines to one defined along civic lines. So my generation was the generation that was caught up in this transitional period and often at the receiving end of animosity that results from the pain caused by a change. In my view, some people needed a new other to reaffirm their Englishness and define themselves against, and we were it. Europe was much further along in this regard, in that identity was still firmly defined along ethnic lines. People from different ethnic backgrounds were forever viewed as foreigners or guest workers in Germany, Gastarbeiter, I think the word is. I can remember meeting Asians from Europe who are noticing how they were so much more connected with the homeland of their parents. It seems that spending years in Europe had made absolutely no impact on them. On the other hand, you had North America. North America had seemed to successfully construct an identity based on civic lines. It was able to offer people from all over the world an identity that was inclusive, accessible, and empowering. American Asians that I met were very proud to be American and much more comfortable with their multifaceted identity. And these differences can also partially be explained by analysis of immigration waves to the two respective countries, with North America receiving being the recipients of more highly skilled and resource-rich migrants. Now, the world outside was hostile for us, but things inside were not much better either. Most people like me grew up with a set of parents who were clinging on to a static South Asian identity. Now, identity was stuck in the Punjab in the 1960s. They were scared of the outside world. And they were scared of their children becoming too Western, scared of raising children who were not just like them. Most of these parents had come to the UK as economic migrants with a 4 or 5 year plan, without really the desire to adapt or change. So they didn't really think they were going to become British and stay here. It's like we're going to work there for 4 or 5 years, make some money, and go back. So their static South Asian identity put them at odds with their children and with British society, and even put them at odds with people in South Asia. So as identity itself was alive and evolving in the Asian subcontinent, South Asian communities in the diaspora in the UK were desperately clinging on to a set of ideals and traditions where people everywhere else are slowly moving away from. Of course, they were no way unique in this regard. In fact, this is quite a common phenomenon which diaspora communities experience. What it meant for people like me is that we were experiencing a sense of dual marginalisation. Not only were we prevented from feeling part of British society, but we didn't fit in at home either. So there was an identity crisis. This identity crisis was further exacerbated by the nature and structure of most Asian or Muslim communities in the UK. The local mosques were dominated and tightly controlled by a group of elderly men who ruled with an iron fist and whose loyalty lay first and foremost with their tribe. They conducted their affairs in Urdu or Punjabi, made no provisions for women, and often displayed a dismissive attitude towards the youth. Nothing has changed there, I can tell you. They also sought to act as gatekeepers, representing the Muslim or the Pakistani vote if ever politicians came fishing for votes. They're happy to deliver them block votes. Most politicians seemed quite content to embrace this very undemocratic approach to dealing with people. Now, the elders in the mosque reminded us of our parents, so we wished to stay away from them as further as possible. We didn't relate to them in any way. And a lot of the imams they employed were not much better either. Most of them spoke no English, taught us very little about our faith, and often were quite ready to resort to violence, in fact, to maintain strict discipline. So we were taught to read the Quran by rote, not understanding a single word. So feeling alienated from mainstream society, estranged from your parents' generation, and let down by the local mosque, the grievances of many young British Muslims in particular were allowed to fester. Many of us were unhappy with the cultural restrictions imposed on us by our parents, but we couldn't challenge our parents either without really feeling guilty. This meant that we couldn't really be ourselves at home, and often had to go along with our parents' wishes, which usually didn't make any sense at all to us. This also resulted in us having to develop multiple personas, you know, one for the home and one for the real world. However, this could lead to real tensions when it came to serious issues such as career choices or relationships. And a famous incident there is a famous Indian actor came home one day and he said to his, he's now a famous actor, he said to his father said, what do you want to be when you grow up? He said, I want to be an actor. And he said, no, it's pronounced doctor. So most of our parents were not comfortable with modern societies where individuals made free choices and developed independent minds and personalities. They took a very dim view of individualism and originality, favouring the comfort offered by conformity and tradition. Most Asian communities also settled in and around kind of drab, decaying inner city areas where unemployment was high, crime ubiquitous, and racial tensions on the rise, like Coventry down the road, for example. Don't go there. We didn't have any positive role models growing up, and so usually ended up idolising people that were involved in crime or street fighting. Racial violence had already polarised many Asian communities and convinced most Muslim South Asians to kind of stick together. And we ended up admiring people that could fight, so whoever was toughest in the area was admired. Street gangs developed, and they were often constructed along racial lines, you know, the Asian gang and the white gang and the black gang. This meant confrontation with authority figures became a regular occurrence, whether the police or the teachers. And such events further consolidated our sense of dislocation and otherness. This also crossed the class divide, with Asians from wealthier families living in nice suburbs being just as affected by the same issues as us. Many of us saw ourselves as victims of this hostile society, and thus anti-establishment tendencies were reinforced from a very early age. It's therefore quite easy to see how radical groups were able to exploit this anger, this frustration, this anti-establishment sentiments of many young Muslims of South Asian origin, and channel it towards extreme theopolitical ideologies. The process I've just described primarily affects the second generation, and in many ways are still ongoing. I was speaking to, I think it was Sally earlier, actually, talking about the 20-year riot theory, which is a theory that I made up. I think it's quite good, actually. It's a theory that whenever a community moves to a different country, after 20 years, there's a riot. And the reason why there's a riot after 20 years is that's when the second generation is about 18, 19, and they're quite angry and pretty pissed off and want to assert themselves. Same thing happened with Brixton in the 80s, and happened with Asian communities in the, about 10 years ago, I think, in Bradford and Oldham. But now we're starting to see the emergence of a third generation, who in many ways are much more comfortable with their environment. And they're starting to see, they have obviously positive role models, which we didn't have. But we're also starting to witness the rise of primarily white working class street protest movements that are not comfortable with what they see around them in inner city areas. So whilst a lot of progress is being made, I think we still have a very long way to go. I'm happy to explore these issues in much more detail during the Q&A. I think I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the invitation. Thanks. I'm honored to be on this panel. It really is an impressive panel. It's a fascinating discussion. I read on the plane the sort of feedback from this recent Davos conference in Switzerland, you know, where the world's CEOs and politicians and movie stars mix and discuss the world's great problems. And it was just an overwhelming sense of pessimism and gloom, I mean, sort of very Swiss. It reminded me of this, It reminded me of this great Woody Allen quotation. He said, you know, life is full of misery, loneliness, and suffering. And what's worse, it's all over with much too soon. There's this sense of pessimism in the world. And I think we all share it at some level. We've been so preoccupied with 9/11 and pandemics and global financial meltdowns and Afghanistan and Iraq and other disasters that we've overlooked the fact that we're living through the most extraordinary period of material progress in human history. We are. In the 17th and 18th centuries, growth rates were lucky to reach 1% a year. By the 19th century, it had inched up to roughly 2% a year. In the 50 years after the Second World War, average growth rates were around 3.5% a year. Now, at the moment we're living in, and over the next several decades, growth rates are projected to be anywhere from 5 to 6% a year. Less than 1%, 5 to 6%. At growth rates like that, economies double in size every decade. Even with the financial crisis, even with the Great Recession, the world economy today is twice as big as it was in 2000. Twice as big in a decade. So what's driving this extraordinary period of growth? What are the big things? I'm going to zero in on three of them. One, the subject we're discussing today. The dramatic rise of the emerging markets, especially in Asia. They're going through today the Industrial Revolution that Manchester and its environs started 300 years ago. It's happening now, finally, in these countries. But it's happening far faster and involving billions of people, not thousands of people. China's had 8 to 10% growth for the last three decades. Uninterrupted. And it just passed Germany as the world's biggest exporter, biggest trader, and it just passed Japan as the world's second biggest economy. It is the biggest economic miracle in history, bar none. And it's not alone. At present trends, India could have a growth rate, exactly your point, a growth rate of 12% a year in the coming decade, making it quite likely the fastest growing economy in the world. Indonesia is growing at 7% a year. The ripple effects are being felt in Latin America, which had a spectacular decade, 4%. Africa, 4 to 5%, even the least developed countries. They don't understand the pessimism because they've never lived through an extraordinary revolution like it. And these growth rates are causing a huge tectonic shift in the global center of economic gravity. In the year 2000, not that long ago, the West, the United States, EU, and Japan made up roughly 74% of the world economy. By 2030, they'll be down to around 28%. Massive shift in economic power. The second big driver of this is obviously globalization and international trade. None of this would be happening without the kind of open and integrated world economy we've created. It's allowed developing countries to harness globalization, to tap into vast, deep, wide export markets for their products, and tap into equally powerful import markets of technology, natural resources, and capital. This phase of globalization is unlike any other. It's wider. Much of this is being driven by South-South trade. It's deeper. It's not just goods, but it's services and intellectual property, the movement of people and ideas. And it's faster. Trade has tripled since the early 1990s. Tripled. In developing countries, their exports have gone up by a factor of 5. These are just numbers, but if you think about it, a factor of 5 in less than 20 years. So this phase of globalization is utterly different. The third major factor is technology, the diffusion of technology and the innovation cycle we're in right now. Technology is both an effect and a cause. It's an effect in the sense that as countries get richer, as markets get more vast, it creates, frees up resources for things like R&D, for education, for absorbing the kind of information that flows on the internet. And it's a cause, obviously, because the developing world now has access to the knowledge, the information, ideas that flow through communication channels like the internet, but also flow through direct foreign investment, the movement of multinationals into these markets and the ideas that come with them. It flows through education exchanges with universities like this. It's always easier to learn something than to invent something. And right now, the world's fast learners are in places like India and China, Pakistan, and elsewhere. And that's why they're catching up so fast. These, I think, are the big three drivers of this phenomenal and extraordinary period of economic growth we're in. Three other related points, just to finish off that picture. One, these forces are mutually reinforcing. They create a virtuous cycle, not a vicious cycle. One of the things that kept developing countries from developing in the past was their lack of access to the basic capacity, the basic building blocks of economic growth. Simple economies like Ethiopia produce simple things like coffee. Complex economies like the United States produce complex things like computers because they had access to hardware, software, legal systems, financing. And because they had access to those basic building blocks of growth, they could produce more things. Computers could lead to the internet. The internet could lead to email. Email could lead to Google. Google could lead to Facebook. While Ethiopia was still producing coffee. That's changed. Globalization is changing that. Suddenly, Ethiopia has access increasingly to these capacities. If there's a bright spark in Addis Ababa who wants to create an app for an iPhone, she can do it. She has the capacity. That never existed 50 years ago. Second point, this is not a zero-sum game. This is not about winners and losers. If China rises, if India rises, it's export markets for the West. Their cheap manufacturing, their more efficient manufacturing, has already benefited us. Check your pocket and see where your cell phone was made or your iPhone was made. It has silently but dramatically increased our living standards and kept inflation in check in the West. Even the technology wars we hear about are not just overblown but basically false. Are we poor as a planet, if China churns out tens of thousands of engineers or invests huge amounts of money in R&D? No. The global pool of technology is richer. Technology, if I share my ideas with you, I don't lose them. They just replicate. And that's essentially what's going on today. Lots of clever people in Manchester and London and Coventry sparked the Industrial Revolution. But we were talking about thousands. We're now talking about hundreds of thousands, of millions, interacting, inventing, and innovating. Is economic growth the whole answer? No, obviously not. But it is a means to an end. It's a means to address some of the basic things that this conference is about: poverty, grinding work conditions, lack of information and rights, lack of empowerment. As Deng Xiaoping said, I can redistribute poverty or I can redistribute wealth. Either way, wealth is at the heart of a lot of global problems we face. Think of living standards. Now, the middle class in the developing world by 2030 will be the same population size as the entire populations of Europe, North America, and Japan put together. Think of health and longevity. The average age, the average life expectancy in China in 1930 was roughly 32 years old. It's now 73 years old. It's approaching our longevities. Think of access to information and education. In 1950, this is phenomenal, but in 1950, almost four-fifths of the world was illiterate. Now, less than a third, closer to a quarter. There are 4 billion mobile phone subscribers in the world now. 4 billion. Just 10 years ago, 750,000. And they use these phones not just to talk, not just to do Twitter, to make financial transactions, to send remittances home, to conduct their businesses. It's a changed world. And think of empowerment. We're watching what's happening in Egypt, in Jordan, in Tunisia, and of course it could happen elsewhere. How possible that be without the information technology that weaves us together? You could make the argument that the internet is now a more important global institution than the UN. Is it all upsides? No. Wealth inequalities. Countries are converging. Like Martin Wolf said in a column 3 weeks ago, we're going through the great convergence. The periphery is becoming the core, and the core is becoming the periphery. We, the core, are becoming the periphery. But within countries, inequalities are increasing. Volatility. As this wave of creative destruction goes throughout the planet, the world seems more unstable and more volatile. Stresses on the environment and our natural resources. Growing, unfulfilled, perhaps unfulfillable expectations. Let's remember from a historical point of view, revolutions begin not during periods of repression, but during periods of reform. And this is nothing if not a period of massive global reform. And finally, the notion of sharing, the one world idea. You know, the John Lennon's phrase, I should have my glasses on for this, but I love this. I'm old enough to like this. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill and die for. No religion to. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one. Your conference, one world. That's what it is. We're living it. We are creating the one world. And the biggest threats to that one world are protectionism, isolationism, racism, nationalism, tribalism, whatever ism you want to use to describe an inward-looking closeness, that's the biggest threat. We're in this together. The best that would come out of a clash between the United States and China would be decreased prosperity and the inability to manage global challenges. The worst would be war. And the challenge for all of us is to make this one world work. It's to make countries like the United States and China realize that as much as they might like to complain about the UN, to gripe about the WTO, to clash at Copenhagen and Cancun, there is no other answer besides multilateral cooperation to making these things work. That no country in this one world, not the United States nor China, is powerful enough to solve its problems on its own. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson and my fellow panelists. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me to be a part of such a distinguished panel. It's a real honor to be here. I had no idea what my other panelists were going to speak about, but just as I was listening to the previous presentation, it's actually unwittingly I'm going to strike a contrary note, but that's fun, right? I mean, that's the whole point about panels, which is people say different things, and hopefully that'll spark a debate. So basically, there's a lot of emphasis on India, China as the emerging superpowers, and you know, we've heard about this just a few minutes ago. And I'm going to just raise a few questions about this scenario that's projected, and you know, in the 10 to 12 minutes that I've been allotted, I cannot do anything more than, and I'm going to share some of the work that I've been doing on India and China, particularly focusing on some of the internal challenges that both of these economies face before they can even aspire to the status of being global superpowers. But I begin the presentation with a quotation from Jawaharlal Nehru, independent India's first prime minister. And if you read the quotation, you can see that India and China were, in a global scenario, were very, very much exciting countries then, and they continue to be now. And so in that sense, they continue to occupy a very important position in global economies in different ways. And at the time that India became independent and China had its revolution, there was a lot of anticipation about the new path of growth and development that these countries were going to follow. And that in fact, explains this quote by Jawaharlal Nehru. The media and also academic attention has been on the spectacular growth that especially the Chinese economy has attained in the last three decades. If you just do a Google search on the number of academic papers that have been written on the growth story, you'll be stumped. It's just a huge amount of attention examining, you know, sources of growth, consequences of growth, and all the rest of it, which I'm not going to touch upon because these stories are too well known. And obviously the belief that comes from this, especially in the popular media, is that because of the high growth that both of these economies have been experiencing and are projected to continue to experience, it is going to tilt the global power towards Asia, with China increasingly calling the shots in international in matters, both economic and political. Now, this is not always seen as a welcome development. There's a lot of apprehension about the fact that this might actually happen. And so depending on where you're located, not just geographically, but also ideologically, you might view this forecast with a lot of applause. You might, you know, applaud this, this forecast, or you might view this with a lot of concern that this will actually tilt, this will actually shift the balance of power in a way that the world becomes unpredictable and, kind of centuries of established balance of power are going to get upset, and we don't know what will result as a result if this shift were to actually happen. And so there are both kinds of stories that we hear, both in the media as well as in academics, about concern or about applause. India and China are also seen as poster children for globalization. And the idea, the story here is that they are supposed to exemplify the unmitigated advantages of global integration and of a market-led path of development. Again, in terms of academics, which is where I come from, and a related story here is that both these countries, especially China, have woken up finally from their socialist slumber and have realized the advantages of a market-led development. And that's what has really made this transition to from a low-growth kind of a scenario to a high-growth scenario. And that's eventually what's going to ensure their status as global superpowers. That's really the story. And to buttress this story, or to kind of emphasize, why as evidence of the proof of the story, one focus has been on the dramatic decline in the number of poor, especially in China, also in India, but it's certainly in China there's been a dramatic reduction in poverty, and there's also a lot of attention on the new wealth in both of these economies. So there's a lot of attention in terms of billionaires, their lifestyles, the new areas of investment, all of that, and what are called high net worth individuals, which it is true that if you look at the rate of growth of the high net worth individuals, it has actually been spectacular in both of these countries, also in India, which has not had as high a rate of growth as China, but has certainly produced a very high, in terms of producing billionaires, or in terms of the rate of growth of the wealth of the billionaires, India has also done spectacularly well. And this is seen, these are some aspects of kind of proof to say that finally global integration is ensuring the fact that, these countries are in fact poster children for globalization. Now, some of the issues that I want to raise here, and this is obviously skimming the surface given the shortage of time, first, that you really need to, this is a thing I'll come back to towards the end of the talk as well, that we really need to unpack India and China a little bit here, in the sense that if you look at the high rate of growth, then China is definitely much more sustained at a much higher rate of growth than India has been, although in the last decade, India's rate of growth has also increased and is projected to increase further. But what you really need to focus on, And a lot of attention has gone on the rate of growth of manufacturing output. There's a projection that by 2050, China will be the largest economy if you measure it in terms of manufacturing. But I think what I'd like to draw your attention towards is if you look at the growth in value added, then China, even today, with all its high rate of growth in manufacturing output, continues to be far behind the industrialized Western economies and also behind Japan. So a lot of the growth in manufacturing does not come from high rate of growth of value added, but it in fact comes from assembling and processing kind of activities. And so one of the challenges that both India and China, both Indian and Chinese manufacturing are going to face is how to rise up in the global value chain. Right? And this is not a trivial fact. So it's not only that one has to focus on the rate of growth of manufacturing, but you also have to see the quality of that manufacturing. And I think the challenge, which I'm not saying that India and China will not overcome, but I'm saying that it exists as a challenge at the moment, which is that they really need to climb up the global value chain and need to increase the rate of growth of value added, not just the rate of growth of manufacturing. And so I think that's something that that I'd like to introduce as a part of the discussion. In terms of role of globalization, of course, this has to be the relationship between globalization and the high rate of growth needs to be empirically established. And in terms of, again, academic material, which is what I'm familiar with, the exact causation has not yet been fully worked out. So all of these remarks are tentative. However, there are some this is based on research that other scholars have done. It turns, if you look at the relationship between globalization and high rates of growth, China's growth has not primarily been export-driven. India's exports, if you look at India's exports, they're mainly skill and capital intensive. And so if you think of high rate of growth in India being a driver for high rate of growth of employment, that's not really, the link doesn't, it doesn't, it's not obvious. That's because the sectors that have seen a high rate of growth have not been sectors that have been employment. And in fact, one of the biggest challenges that the Indian economy is facing today is the low rate of growth of employment. We even had a decade of what is called a jobless growth, which is the rates of growth of high, but rates of growth of employment were not high. And that has consequences on a lot of inequality and poverty-related issues. India's growth is also mainly service sector-driven. And it's not only the IT sector, which is the more well-known success story, but a lot of the growth is also coming from the unorganized small-scale services. And so what really this suggests is that there's a significant role of domestic factors in explaining the high rate of growth of both China and India. So in terms of the relationship between globalization and high rates of growth, this definitely puts a question mark on the robustness of that relationship. This is not to say that globalization has had no role to play. Of course not. But when we are isolating, unraveling the strands in terms of what contributes to growth, one has to also focus on matters that are internal to both the economies and not just on the link with the global economy, which of course has had. And as I said, that in terms of proving these relationships, these are difficult issues to prove, because you have to control for a lot of other factors when you're unraveling. And so this is an area which is expanding in terms of academic attention, but it's really, you really need to keep in mind that this relationship is extremely complicated. And you really need academic rigorous academic research to prove with certainty the relationship between globalization and high rate of growth. Now, one of the areas that I have been working on is inequality. And I've just been given a two-minute, so I'm going to now just rush through the rest of the presentation. So basically, this slide talks about a rise in inequality in all dimensions for India and China. And, we've calculated Gini coefficients both for India and China. For India, Gini coefficients, which is a measure of inequality, which if it is equal to zero, then there's no inequality. If it's equal to one, then it's completely one person has all the income. And so you have to really look at whether the ratio is closer to zero or to one. And in India, because of the peculiarities of data availability, inequalities are calculated on monthly per capita expenditure. Whereas for China, we have estimates both for income with income data as well as for consumption data. And these are some of the numbers. For India, you can see that inequality has risen, particularly in the phase of reforms. All right? And what we also try to do is to try to decompose inequality. And I can answer some questions on this when I come to, which is, you can, like, for example, if you take rural versus urban, you can see the proportion of inequality which is within rural or within urban, and proportion of inequality between rural and urban. And if you look at the first part of the chart, you can see that the between rural urban has actually doubled over the period of reforms. So there is in fact a lot of evidence to suggest that and similarly between states and between regions, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the reform process in India has been accompanied by an increase in inequalities. And it's the same story for China, except that, as you can see, the numbers are higher. But that's also because Chinese inequalities are also calculated on income figures, which income figures typically give higher inequality proportion. I mean, if in India, if you could calculate inequality on income, it would perhaps be higher than what we are getting from based upon consumption. And if you look at Chinese decompositions by rural-urban, then the proportion of between rural and urban is double that of India. So it's 42.5 for China, whereas it was about roughly about 19 point something, about 20 for India. So basically the point is that rural-urban gaps are much sharper in China than they are in India. I'll skip this. So basically coming back to the whole question of whether India and China are poster children for globalization, you in fact find that for India, for example, the rate of decline in poverty did not accelerate in the phase of high reforms. So the more dramatic declines in poverty were achieved before the reforms really started. Similarly for China, and there's a foundation called the Heritage Foundation, which has something called the Index of Economic Freedom, and both China and India rank very low. Out of a total of 157 countries, India has an index of India ranks at 115, and China ranks at 126. And both countries are in the group called mostly unfree. And so basically the point is that if you look at orthodox measures of what, if you look at the orthodox measures of market-driven growth, then neither India nor China actually fulfill those kind of orthodox measures. And there are actually a lot of contrary features. And so putting a whole question mark about whether these two economies are poster children for globalization. Implications for the future. Both governments are confronted with consequences of rising inequality, social upheaval, unrest, violent agitations. I can talk about this more during the question-answer session. And obviously, this has clear policy implications that both countries need to pay urgent attention to inequality-enhancing features of the growth model. China has a significant legacy from the socialist period, which is now being denied both by the Chinese as well as by the Western commentators. But there is a view that that legacy, in fact, has played a big role to play. It's provided a foundation on the basis of which growth could actually accelerate. India was never socialist in that sense, but the state did play an important role immediately in the post-independence period. And so really, the question of whether China and India will become global superpowers is a question of whether they are able to overcome the formidable internal challenges that that this growth process has posed for them. Thank you very much. Sorry for that.
My dear young friends, it is indeed a pleasure for me to come here to the Warwick University and address the One World Week Forum. I'm a stranger in the house because, as you know, my foreign minister was supposed to be here today to speak, to make his speech here. Unfortunately, he couldn't come, and I have been asked to substitute, rather put myself in his shoes, and they are tighter. Your topic, East and West, economics and politics, is a very interesting subject and has been very professionally dealt by the distinguished panelists here, and I congratulate them for that. I've gained, indeed, a lot from their deliberations and their speeches. Since I'm the last one to speak, I'd like to take this opportunity to lend perspective to the relationship of Pakistan with the region Asia and that with the West. The politics and economics of Asia and the West, no doubt, is the linchpin of the global system. Pakistan is 64 years old. It is now 26th largest economy in the world in terms of GDP, purchasing power parity. We are the third largest English-speaking nation in the world. It is a large market of more than 170 million people with an average GDP worth a growth rate of plus 5% during the last 8 years. But you must remember that during the last 8 years, we have been passing through a period of turmoil, although not the last 8 years, but as a matter of fact, we have had 30 years of war that is still going on, terrorism, and recently we had floods that almost destroyed one-fifth of the country. Well, our land mass is more than the territory that France and Germany have, but despite this, we have the largest number of troops contributing to the United Nations peacekeeping force. The World Bank Ease of Doing Business report of 2011 lists Pakistan as number 83, India at 133, and China at 79. And all this in spite of surrounding volatile neighborhood. We have Afghanistan in the west, Iran as well, India and China in the east and northeast. Some of the more crucial issues facing the world concern this region as it India, Russia, China, Iran, and Afghanistan and Pakistan. Issues confronting Pakistan, ladies and gentlemen, are undercutting the economy and political stability. Then watershed of the volatility of our region is very evident. The breach of law and international doctrine of peace in Kashmir are matters which underpin the need for security and defense for Pakistan. Guardians of the international frontiers of peace, liberty, and freedom must come forth to show their sagacity in a broad and transparent manner to bring peace and development to the region. The people and the institutions have great, Pakistani people and the institutions have great pride in their success and strive for more balanced and influential position on the world decision-making tables. The government of the Pakistan People's Party has come to power after almost a decade of military rule, underwritten by the democratic West, whose leaders once had ideals of making world safe for democracy, but whenever their geopolitical interest came up in the region, they rushed to the first military dictator to put the back, to pat him back and to put him in power. After having your scholarly in-depth presentations on politics and economics and other developments in the region, my submission on Asian and Western politics and economic could be a drop in the bucket. But I will be as candid as the occasion demands to be frank. As a journalist associated with the profession for over 45 years, and also being a student of politics and history, I will try to articulate the emerging trends that are shaping political and economic policies of the Asian region, with particular reference to South Asia and Pakistan. The post 9/11 scenario has brought instability in Pakistan, the world which was supposed to have entered a period of crusade. And despite our eminent panelists saying that, talking of technological advancement and everything that has gone around the world, which relates to progress and everything, including development of cluster bombs, nuclear bombs, and everything, all that could kill, they have not been able to produce something that could counter SB, that is a suicide bomber. And that is what is causing the trouble the world over. Our mission is to turn the tables on Taliban. Initially, the public perception considered the war on terror as America's war. However, the overwhelming majority in the country now favors the strongest measures against the arcane and obscurantist forces that have tried to despoil the peaceful atmosphere in the region. You must remember, last year, over 2 million people, 2.5 million people, got displaced from Malakand and Sawat in the north. And it goes to their resilience that after 6 months, after the Pakistan armed forces cleared the area of those Talibans and terrorists, those people have gone back home, although the Taliban destroyed their schools, colleges, especially the girls' schools, the girls' education institutions, hospitals, and everything. They have gone back and they're trying to get back on their feet. And the good news is Taliban are on the run. The command and control structures have been broken. There are suicide and IED attacks, but people are resolute to defeat the Taliban phenomena. Public ownership to the military operations Sawat and Malakand and in South Waziristan have given a strong message to extremists that the democratic forces in the country would not allow them to implement the agenda through force. And this is the strong message which a democracy can give in such conditions as has been witnessed in Pakistan. There are reasons for this optimism. For the first, the country has a democratic order which came into being through a long and sustained political struggle, uprooting a longly entrenched, undemocratic government in Pakistan. Secondly, we have a vibrant civil society which guarantees for democratic order and remains alive to day-to-day developments in political, economic, and cultural and religious fields. Thirdly, an independent judiciary is the greatest hope for the country as it is now trying to streamline institutions that had been subverted, dislocated, fractured by the military rulers. And fourthly, a fiercely independent media is playing the role of a watchdog, which is a good omen for sustaining a democratic order in the country. Pakistan's People's Party's martyred leader, Muhtarma Benazir Bhutto, had always been pleading while she was living in exile with the countries and friendly countries of the West that democracy is the answer, is the best answer to counter terrorism. But for 10 years, nobody listened to her and allowed Taliban and the military dictators to blackmail the West. Today, Pakistan is going through a difficult time because of the floods. We incurred a loss of about $45 billion. Standing crops were destroyed. Roads and bridges were destroyed. And one-fifth of the population was dislocated from their houses. But unfortunately, instead of coming to our help, travel advisories are issued that stop people from visiting Pakistan or investing in Pakistan. We have been pleading to our friends, distinguished friends, that a political solution of the Afghan problem has the potential of addressing the security situation in that country. Already, Al-Qaeda has been decimated to a great extent. No more Al-Qaeda places a threat from our region. It can be paralyzed further by addressing the Middle East problem. I don't know what is going to happen to the Middle East. A wave of dislocation has started with Tunisia and now Egypt, and Jordan is also rocking. So we don't know where the wind will take them to. However, I must flag that some countries in the region, instead of playing a positive role for the stability of Afghanistan, are trying to fulfill their agenda by interfering in Afghanistan's internal affairs and using its territory to destabilize Pakistan. Poverty, ladies and gentlemen, and illiteracy in Pakistan or our region are no doubt problems that need immediate attention of any government in order to sustain the democratic order anywhere. To address the problem of poverty and illiteracy, the countries of South Asia will have to overcome the problems, especially relating to interstate relations. Pakistan has been pleading for SAARC's conversion into Asia Economic Union on the pattern of EEC. And I'm sure all these gentlemen who are very distinguished and learned scholars know that what is the poverty line in our part of the world? More than 40% people live under poverty line. Both in Pakistan, India, or even China, one third of their populations live under the sky. They don't have any shelter. What to talk of clothing and other things. And definitely, there's economic growth everywhere. We talk of globalization. I don't know what sort of globalization is taking place, because my friends, visa restrictions are increasing every day. Nobody can go here and there without visa. Instead of spending on education, healthcare, or social sectors, most of the countries are spending billions and trillions of dollars on building arms and armies. I think one-tenth of that money which is being spent on armament manufacture could bring about a revolution in literacy and socio-economic sectors. If we broaden our horizon to Asia, it is emerging as the leading continent in economic terms. South Asia is the largest continent, with three-fourths of the humanity living on its landmark. Its potential to emerge as economic leader had always been felt and recognized by the scholars and statesmen like you. China, India, and ASEAN are moving with a phenomenal pace. But has all the progress, all the economic gains trickled down to the poor people or the starving people? I was just, half asleep when I heard on television that it was either WHO report or FAO report that 40 million more people will starve this year. As I stated earlier, despite grappling with terrorism and extremism, Pakistan, the economic indicators in Pakistan are looking up with the acquisition of preferential treatment by EU and necessary waiver by WTO, Pakistan's economy can turn around in the shortest possible time, provided we are helped. According to World Bank economists, who examined the post crisis policy outlook, developing countries could overtake their developed peers collectively in size as soon as 2015. The World Bank sees four global trends unfolding that will enable emerging economies to raise productivity by harnessing better technologies. Ladies and gentlemen, first, less advanced countries are joining international supply chains, specializing initially to developing country settings. Second, booming South Asia, South-South trade is diffusing technologies that have been tested and adapted to developed country settings. Third, information and communication of technology is getting cheaper and cheaper and more widely used. And finally, as the middle class flourishes in emerging countries, local technological adaptations begins to break even. Fourth, introduction of chief technologies may give an edge in the coming years to developing countries to overtake the West. This is my statement, but I beg to slightly differ with it. Our previous dictator, General Musharraf, once came on television and he said the barometer of progress in Pakistan today is that we have got over 20 million mobile phones and X number of cars, because during his periods he allowed mobile phones to be leased out by the banks, cars to be leased out. Anybody who could earn 10,000 rupees could buy a car on leasing. Even beggars have mobile phones. But in the real terms of progress, about over 200,000 people everywhere getting unemployed. So that is the situation that we have inherited. The emerging Asian economies, my friends, have definitely made a mark in the global economic scene. This has also given rise to competition within Asian economies as well as the West. Because of the comparative advantages these countries enjoy in cheap labor and raw material. However, it does not mean that the West is lagging behind. The West is still a leader in high technology, and it would be the case that the rest of the world would be able to match those capabilities, although one could notice the presence of Asian workforce in such research and development sectors of the West. We have learned a lot from the West, but Europe learned its lesson after bloodshed and wars spread over many centuries. It first separated religion from the state. Don't you think, ladies and gentlemen, Governor Salman Taseer's murder had some similarity with the Spanish Inquisition, when people spoke truth were burnt alive at the stake and got out of this dark ages of religious fanaticism. Then they fought wars on economic spoils to monopolize them. There too, they succeeded for some decades and prospered by inflicting miseries to their colonies. Then the aftermath of the two world wars opened their eyes to adopt policies of cooperation with each other, mutual help, and to share that all could enjoy fruits of progress and prosperity. We have today entered a new age of media explosion, where news can travel within seconds from one corner of the world to another. The media explosion has brought about immense changes in the global scenario. The media technology has brought about socio-political changes in many societies which were earlier considered to be autocratic, but tolerated by the West because of natural resources or fear of extremists taking over power, and of course with their geopolitical interest pursuing double standards or justifying evil in the name of expediency. However, the events of Tunisia and now in Egypt are enough indicators of the likely changes that can occur in the near future in the Middle East. Finally, ladies and gentlemen, I must flag my concern with regard to media explosion and its selective views by developed countries to promote the interests at the cost of socioeconomic exploitation of developing nations. An equitable order, I insist, with an inbuilt mechanism for dispute resolution and promotion of fair trade practices can offer a win-win solution to the global world, more so to Asia and the West. But the successes of this ideal would require political will and a determination to resolve disputes through peaceful means. I'd like to end with a quote from Alexander the Pope, the great poet, who said, "What war could ravish, commerce could bestow, and he returned a friend who was a foe." Ladies and gentlemen, it was indeed a pleasure for me to be with you, although I was not fully prepared for this occasion, and as was supposed to, the foreign minister was supposed to be here. But before I leave this podium, I must emphasize that, with my total apologies, with all the intellectuals sitting here, that new world order, globalization, world as a village, global village, they all seem to have ended up as clichés coined by us. They have not been translated into practical, you know, solutions to the problems faced by the humanity. Thank you very much.